guest today is creator of the fabulous YouTube series Steam Locos and Profile, Chris Eden Green. Chris.
Hello, Corwin.
Welcome to Railway Mania.
Thank you very much for having me.
Please, could you explain what your YouTube channel is and what the various shows on YouTube channel are?
Well, my YouTube channel is just my name, but the trademark show that people know me for is Steam Locos in Profile, which, to anyone who's never heard of it before, you can imagine it as sort of like Top Gear, but for steam locomotive enthusiasts. You know, we take a run through individual locomotive classes over a course of about 15 to 20 minutes per film, where we look at the concept of each design, why it came about, how it came about, the history of them, how they were developed, where they worked, etc. They're good points, so how fast could they go, what could they pull, how were they good compared to their contemporaries. They're not so good points, faults, reliability issues, things that, you know, mainstream television just wouldn't talk about. And then we go through their decline in the BR days, usually, or whenever they were due for withdrawal. And we finish up with their preserved careers today. We usually look at three or four individual examples of said class and then see how they sort of fit in the grand scheme of the fleet of preserved steam engines.
And this series actually has its own spin-off series.
It does to a degree, yes. With Steam Locos in Profile, we tend to look at classes that are preserved in quantity because they're partly easier to film and there's also more to talk about in that regard. Whereas the spin-off, which is called Soul Slip, Slip is an acronym of Steam Locos in Profile, and then Soul is the reference to Soul Surviving types of engines, you know, one of a kind. Then we tend to look at them over the course of about 2 or 3 minutes. Admittedly, compress some of the history down, but it's a lot easier to film an episode of Soul Slip as just a series of close-ups rather than chasing an engine all over the country, if it does work all over the country, or if it's just standing still in one place and never going to work again. Then it's easier to compress it down to 2 minutes rather than try and stretch it out over 15, which could potentially get a little bit difficult, seeing as you can only get so many close-ups of the same engine.
The videos are about locos that are still extant, so they're not about extinct steam loco classes.
That's correct.
And is that due to the ability to film them?
It would be possible if I had access to a mountain of archive material to do something about types of engine which are extinct. Because to be fair, there's a lot of fascinating stories behind extinct types of locomotives that were okay in their time and haven't been preserved against all the odds. But because I don't have that access, it's difficult to review anything without sort of imagining something in thin air, you know. People often say to me, why don't you do something about extinct types of engine? And the answer is, I don't have anything to film them with.
And I guess the contemporary reports you're relying on are so old now, there's not much in the way of recent experience with those locos.
There is that as well. I mean, one of the types of engine which I'm constantly asked about is the London Brighton and South Coast Railway E2060 tank engines. Easy to think why. Sort of examine why they were so popular in another of my spin-off shows, Gauge the Issue, which talks about railway-related issues in media, anything which sort of the mainstream press don't talk about but ought to talk about. Looking at the E2s, it was kind of fascinating to discover just how rubbish they were. Sorry, Thomas fans, if you're listening, but they kind of were. But no, the reason why they're so coveted is kind of interesting, why people think that they were so great and they unfortunately weren't, but that's not to say that Thomas is bad, it's just that the type weren't bad.
It's Bryson propaganda, I think.
I'm confirming or denying nothing because I get told off enough often enough.
Now about your history, what was your introduction to railways and was there any family association with it and how did you get into the hobby?
It's weird because none of my family were interested in trains. My mum tells me that I caught the bug before I was even born. I was born in Harrogate in 1987 and around that time, Mallard, of course, was running around the northeast. My mum took my elder sister, who was about 2.5 years older than me, to Harrogate to see Mallard coming through, and she says that as the engine passed through the station, the exhaust got into her system and in turn got into me.
It's a bit like when people say about pregnant women putting headphones with classical music playing on, just indoctrinating your kids from an early age into steam locos sounds like a good way to go.
I can just remember being old enough to run up and down platforms chasing steam engines at all sorts of heritage lines. We moved down to Kent in the early 90s and my family used to take me to the Bluebell and the Kentley Sussex, and my interest in them expanded through watching direct-to-video programs about steam locomotives and whenever there was one on the television. If there was a film or a TV show that had trains in it, I would normally see it just for the sake of seeing the steam engine in action.
Well, I think especially for young kids, obsessions like that are quite common. Like, being obsessed about a subject is quite common, and for some people that is steam trains. It certainly was for me. Anything that was on TV, my mum would record on VHS, and I would watch it over and over and over again.
It's good to find some common ground.
How did that come around to directing a YouTube channel aimed at fellow hobbyists?
That came along much, much later. I joined YouTube at the start of 2007, but I didn't really do that much with it, to be honest, other than just watch stuff on YouTube. Then, when I got to the age of about 20, 21, 22, I started rewatching some of the stuff that I used to watch as a child, like the Castle Video VHS tapes and generic stuff about trains and railways. And I remember getting a bit cheesed off with how they were not very well shot, but the information was all there. Sometimes the presentation felt a bit lackluster. That presented another problem as well. With stuff that was produced for television, the production values were much, much better, but the information was missing in, to some degree.
Did you find that a lot of them just repeated the same facts over and over again? Or had to tell the entire story of the railways from the start over and over again?
Some of them I did. I guess it depends on the actual content of the programmes themselves. Steam Days didn't necessarily repeat the same info over and over again because they were looking at, in some cases, individual types of engines. Age 21, 22, I was re-watching all of these programmes alongside some of the newer content that BBC 4 was putting out, like Julia Bradbury's Railway Walks and Tom Ingalls' first film about Tornado. And again, I thought they were very well shot and well produced, but for anyone who was specifically interested in steam locomotives, there wasn't that much. And then a year later, I saw that one episode of Top Gear that every steam railway enthusiast knows, where Tornado was raced against the Jaguar XK120 and the Vincent Black Shadow motorbike. And I looked at that and thought, this is stunning. Why haven't we got something like this? Mm. And, you know,
And it's one of my favourite episodes as well, I think, because they're caricatures that they inhabit kind of switched off for that, and they were genuinely quite keen. And it seemed like there was a lot of passion there.
Yeah, you wouldn't see Jeremy Clarkson as someone who was interested in steam locomotives, but for that, he was genuinely enthused by it. Even if James May said that he wanted to go on the train instead. But
I think James Gamey got his revenge in the end.
Yeah, that's payback, Clarkson.
Associating slips with Top Gear, I would say it's more similar to, say, 90s Top Gear than the 2000s era reboot. So it's more focused around the actual subject matter. There's a lot of facts, there's a lot of stories about the history of these vehicles.
A lot of people say that it is essentially Top Gear, but for steam engines. But, and I would say that too, however, I was very conscientious not to copy the three middle-aged blokes falling over, catching fire and upsetting the Mexicans every week formula. I thought it's probably a wiser idea just to look at steam locomotives in great quantity and try and feed viewers with as much of the information about the machines as possible, but without giving absolutely everything away, so that people would look at it and think, oh, this is an interesting looking machine, I'd like to find out more about it, and then they go and find out more for themselves elsewhere.
It's like a springboard, really. Well, it can give someone at least a base level of working knowledge about something in order to be able to hold a conversation about it, or to understand what someone's referring to when they say, oh, this Black 5 loco has very unusual valve gear, for example.
Yes.
Let's rewind back to, it's 2007, you started a YouTube channel. How long and what process was it from there to get to the point you are today, or the point where you launched into making this content?
In 2007, though, I started going on holiday with a few friends of mine who were also railway enthusiasts. We went to places like, we did North Wales for 3 years in a row, and then we did Yorkshire for a week, and then the South East for a week, and Isle of Man for another week, year by year by year sort of thing. And one of the things we used to do was point of view style vlogs about our days out, which were just mostly shots of us around messing around on the trains, set to whatever music that we fancied. I didn't really consider filmmaking as a career at that point. I was actually a mechanical engineer in those days, so very, very different kettle of fish. As one of those people who got involved with the filming and the editing of these videos, a few of my friends said to me, you know, you're really good at this. Why don't you consider doing it for a career? And at first I didn't take them too seriously. I thought, nah, I'm not that good at this. I'll never be able to make something out of it. And it was only when I looked back at some of the stuff that mainstream television was doing and then compared it to what I'd been shooting, I thought, do you know what, these guys might actually have a point. So by December 2009, I came back from a concert one night, buzzing with excitement, having seen one of my favourite bands live, started trolling through YouTube trying to find clips of that gig that night. Couldn't find anything, but during my search I came across lots of YouTubers who were reviewing things like films, games, toys, TV shows, a few other channels of people who were recording days out on various heritage railways, and were just generic railway montage videos. There was no show that was specifically reviewing steam locomotives. And I thought, well, no one else is doing it. Why don't I have a go and see how hard it could be? From January 2010, I then started work, and hoping to have an episode out that year, I went off and shot anything that would possibly move, and hoping that eventually that I would have enough rushes of each type of engine to put it all together, which is more or less how it works now. But it wasn't until January 2012 that the first episode of Slips finally went out, after many false starts and, you know, late nights and much investment in equipment and then much investment in other equipment when the first lot of equipment turned out to be rubbish, etc., etc.
I can certainly relate to that.
Yeah, there was a lot of trial and error, a lot of hard work, a lot of blood, sweat, toil, and 2012 is when it all started.
And what was the first episode you put out?
That was about the LMS Black Fives. It was partly by choice because I wanted to talk about types of engines which Joe Public was generally familiar with, so very famous ones like the Black Fives, the London Brighton South Coast Railway Terriers, the Great Western Castles, the Gresley A4s, the Bully Pacifics.
These are iconic locos.
Yeah, iconic locos in their own right. It would only be after the show were to ever get popular that I would then start to go into the more nitty-gritty ones that the enthusiasts may not necessarily care for, like the Austerities or the BR Standard 4 Moguls, or ones which have a following of some degree but may not be as big a following as the likes of the A4s, for instance.
How did Steam Locos and Profile go from being a YouTube show that you'd spent this time doing? How did you transition from mechanical engineering to doing this as your main form of employment?
More out of necessity than anything else. I tried producing the show and working full-time as an engineer in 2010, but the amount of time and effort that it took to produce an episode of Slips was too much. By that time, I was getting a little bit invalided out of mechanical engineering, shall we say. You know, I was the youngest in my firm by about 30-odd years, and there was a bit of ageism going on there, and my boss at the time was a bit of a prat. Eventually, I just thought, I don't want to do this anymore, so I want a change of direction. And it was a difficult decision to make because it was steady employment and all that, even though I hated it. So I took the plunge and went to film school. Spent 4 years studying at Ravensbourne University in East London. That sort of helped me to develop my skills as a filmmaker. You know, when I went in, I didn't know the first thing about white balance and focus points and all the rest of it. And when I came out the other end, more or less transformed in all those regards. Okay, I'm still learning new things as I go along, but you do these things as a filmmaker anyway. You know, in any other form of media, you're always learning new stuff. By the start of 2013, when the show finally started to become popular, it was about a year into production, people then started asking me, would you ever consider selling some of these episodes on a DVD, because I'd quite like to own a copy. I tried not to look at my expenses in those days, but then looking at my accounts and how much I'd spent on the show by that point, I thought, this has got to make its own money somehow, because I can't afford to make it otherwise. I then took it to a couple of television firms and tried to pitch it for television, effectively. I tried pitching a similar show to Steam Locos in Profile and a film which I'd made for university, a half-hour documentary about what's left of the Great Central Railway, and tried to pitch both of those shows to as many broadcast firms as I could. ITN, attached to Channel 4 News, said that they liked what I did, but they wouldn't accept it as it was. I would have to go away and reshoot it. And then on top of that, they said, oh, we can't pay you for it. BBC4 were a little bit nicer about it. They allowed me to talk them through both the ideas I had with all of the proposals that I had for budgets and shooting schedules and all the rest of it. The commissioning editor said to me, well, these ideas are all very well and good, but they're not really what we're looking for, but good luck anyway. And so I was sent away and thought, okay, well, it's going to have to survive on DVD then, because I can't afford to keep this up anymore. I launched a crowdfunding campaign to put the first 8 episodes of Slips at that point onto a DVD, which ended up as Steam Locos in Profile Volume 1, with a bonus film which we made specially for that DVD. Within a few months, we had our project have been crowdfunded by the generous fans and was available on DVD. And ever since then, I've tried to put a new collection of films out every year.
I think that's really interesting because YouTube gets a lot of flack, especially these days, and especially with the way that they change content is made. But I think the original purpose of YouTube in the commercial sense, in that it's diversifying filmmaking for people, it's opening out an audience to people who might not have been able to achieve it. Your stories with the trying to get commissioners interested, is a case in point, but you were able to cultivate a following online. I think that's really interesting. How did that fan base build?
Gradually. It built initially from close friends of mine, within railway circles or from the group of friends that I used to go on holiday with, and we were quite well connected with other people, other rail fans and so on around the world. I wouldn't say that it's never gone insanely viral like any of the mainstream stuff does, because, you know, niche subjects very rarely do, but even by 2012 standards, I was amazed really to have one video achieve more than 1,700 views in its first week of publication. You know, I thought that if I could get 200, 300, 400, 500 views within a month on one of my videos, then I'd be a fairly happy bunny. The first episode went out and it did okay. It got its 500 views within its first month, but then the second episode, which was about London, Brighton and South Coast Railway Terriers, went out and that achieved 1,700 views within 1 week and 3,000 within a second week, which for me was actually quite impressive. And
I think at that time, 2012, I mean, I've been making films for YouTube since the start, I guess, for other people commercially, and I feel like view counts have become somewhat twisted over the years, especially with Facebook video, and I think view counts have become quite inflated. I think in 2012 getting that number of views is actually very impressive, and it's very good because there weren't that many people discovering stuff on YouTube at that time, and the type of content that was being made was quite different.
That's true, actually. Certainly, even by 2009, when I came up with the idea for Slips, there were comparatively few YouTubers who were actually reviewing stuff. It was still mostly a place for personal pratfalls and city cat videos and so on. 3, 4, 5 years later, you've suddenly got big independent studios which are starting up and producing shows specifically for YouTube, which are on the same or similar budget as mainstream television.
I think it was the start of the YouTube Partner Program that really kick-started that, where they invested heavily in lead channels, which encouraged more people to put more effort into making shows that were entertaining and repeat shows as well. So you'd have a theme along a channel. It wouldn't just be one-off videos that would occasionally do well. You'd get things like Slips, where you'd have a theme and it appeals to a specific audience. If you look at something like Freddie W, now known as Rocket Jump in the States, his videos were weekly, all geared towards people who enjoyed action movies and video games. They were all VFX based, and he cultivated his audience in that sense and quite a dedicated following, and was able to crowdfund a series out of it. Similarly, for railway enthusiasts, obviously it's a smaller market, but I think to get a piece of that market share at that point in time, I think that is pretty excellent. To an untrained eye, someone might not have thought that there was a need for this, like the commissioner that you talk about. I think it takes an enthusiast and someone who's passionate about the subject to notice there is a niche here. I can make something that people are missing, but they don't know they're missing it yet.
Yeah. People don't tend to ask for the best ideas from what I can see, but it's only when the best ideas come along that they suddenly realise that if it went away, then they couldn't live without those ideas. So I think you're right in that regard, that the general enthusiasts wouldn't know that they would miss something like Slips until it went.
We've talked a little bit about monetization. How do you make your YouTube channel pay its way and wash its face and be able to compensate you for the time that you put into making it?
To be honest, a lot of the revenue for Slips is generated through DVD sales and through download sales. I realised quite early on that the ad revenue from YouTube was so low that it could never really sustain Slips in the long run. So a lot of people say that I'm quite old-fashioned for sticking with DVD sales. You know, it's a dying format in some regards, but, you know, because preservation is essentially conserving the past, conserving something which is more tangible than something that's just through the airwaves, then there's still a lot of people around who still prefer DVDs over anything digital.
It's that feeling of ownership, I think. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Streaming is not the same kind of feeling. Streaming is borrowing it for a bit, whereas that feeling of ownership of something that's tangible, I think especially railway enthusiasts appreciate more.
Okay, there are a lot of younger people in railway preservation who would rather go for a digital form of media, either because it's easier for them or they don't have to worry about shipping costs if it's overseas, or if they would prefer something which is of higher quality, then yes, you can get a HD version of something digitally.
Yeah. Did anybody help you along the way?
Yes, from day one, really. I had Adam Ashford, who has been on the podcast previously. He's been filming railways since YouTube virtually began. He was one of the few YouTubers on YouTube in its early days who were producing video montages about his days out at Heritage Railways, and he was one of the better videographers that I could find at that time. And we met on one of the holidays that I took with my friends to North Wales, and in about, I think it was March 2010, knowing that while I would try to film as much of and produce the show as much of myself as I could, I knew that I couldn't do all of it myself. And seeing as I was in the southeast, Adam was in the southwest, and I thought perhaps he could be a good sort of correspondent for me in that regard, video correspondent in the southwest. I approached him and asked, if Slips does become popular, would you mind if I were to use any footage that you have? If it does become popular, then we can come to an arrangement on how we share the credit and the proceeds and so on. And very kindly, he obliged. The other cameraman is a chap called Sam Brown, who was a filmmaker in his own regard. He's done a lot of entries for the British International Amateur Film Festival for years and years and years, and very well regarded in that sense. But he was enthusiastic about railways too. We met on a fly-on-the-wall visit to Stewart's Lane Depot to see Clan Line, and then we started going to Heritage Lines together. And initially, he didn't come on board as a cameraman, but when we went to film at the National Railway Museum to film presenting bits for the Black Fives and the A4s episodes, long story short, I had to take him along to hold the camera for me because the National Railway Museum got a little bit iffy about people using tripods. I'm thankful that he did come on board, but that wasn't initially the intention.
Technically, it's a collaborative effort. Creatively, how much input do you all have on it?
Sam and Adam don't do much beyond filming extra bits and pieces, although they do help me out with planning big shoots. Like if we do a big shoot overseas, for instance, and all three of us have got to be there, then Sam does a lot on the planning ahead and the logistical side of things. Adam also helps out with graphic design and photography. He's designed all of my DVD covers. He does all of the artwork and so on for the Facebook page and things like that. Both brilliant in that regard. But about 80% of the creative work on Slips is done by me. And that's partly because of budget, because I don't have the money for a full crew, and I'll never have that sort of income. And I think it's unfair to use people for nothing. You know, I'd much rather solve the problem, and you can't really solve the problem by adding to it, you know, saying to interns, oh, well, would you mind doing this for me? It'll look good on your CV. And
it'll be great exposure.
Yeah, great exposure and all of that rubbish that never really benefits whoever's doing the work. It was also partly out of principle, because you can have a huge crew and a huge budget for your show, but your show can still be rubbish. Whereas you can produce something that's in a shed with two people and produce some of the best shows that people can remember. Mm-hmm. You know, you've only got to compare the likes of Trainspotting Live to anything that Oliver Postgate turned out. Which one had the bigger crew and budget, but which one ultimately was better?
So we've talked about steam locomotives in profile on the channel and mm-hmm. on YouTube and DVD sales. Let's talk about the production process.
Yeah.
How long does the average episode take to make? I know that you said you spent a year making the first few.
Yeah, it took about 2 years to make the first few, but well, the time scale of each episode depends entirely on which locomotive it is. They can take anything between 18 months and, so far, 8.5 years. 8.5 years is the longest I've spent putting an episode together, and that was the LMS Jinties. The reason why each episode takes so long is because I'm literally filming a checklist of about 30 or more types of engine at any one time, and I have to sort of divide my time over the course of a year, focusing on whichever engine's running, where it's running, when it's running, and whether or not I can actually get to it to shoot it. You can't just necessarily pick and choose where you want to go. You can to a point, but then if a locomotive is due to go out of service at the end of a certain period of time, you have to go and get it within that certain period of time and correlate your free days with its operating days, because once you lose those operating days and it goes out of ticket, that's it. You could probably wait for another 10, 15 years before it returns to service.
And that's not even taking into account failures, washouts, the loco being out of service on that particular day for any reason.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why Soul Slip ended up being episodes which ended up at 2 or 3 minutes in length of static shots was largely because in the first couple of years I thought, well, this shouldn't be any problem. I'll just film anything that moves, and by eventually over a long enough period of time I should have enough shots of each one to make up 15, 20 minutes of film. But then when City of Truro was withdrawn from service in early 2013 ahead of the end of its boiler ticket, I only had about 5 shots and I wasn't even very happy with those. And I thought, well, I'm probably going to be dead before this thing returns to traffic. So for a while, I thought no more Soul Survivors because that's just going to be too difficult. And I think if you're going to try and pad an episode out over 15 minutes and it's just static shots, visually at least it's going to look dull. You might have the history and the stories to back it up. And you could potentially get people who worked on them to talk about it on camera, but there's not so many people who have the authoritative experience with said locomotives around to speak with. And even the ones that are left, it's very difficult to get them to talk on camera. I remember I tried interviewing a chap who was perfectly happy talking, but then as soon as the cameras went on, he didn't want to speak. And I remember another thing when one of my cameramen and I, we did another project about 50 years since the end of Steam on the Southern Region. We went to Stewart's Lane Depot to film Clanline when she was being serviced. And we tried to interview one of the guys who had been there from day one. And he was a really enthusiastic, knowledgeable chap, really authoritative figurehead within the Merchant Navy Locomotive Preservation Society. But he wouldn't talk on camera.
Why is that? Is that shyness or is that not willing to put themselves out publicly? Do you think that's a reflection of how they perceive the media these days? They don't know how their image is going to be used?
It could be any number of reasons based on the individual, but I think a lot of it is down to how they fear that the information might be used. You know, would it be taken out of context or would they showcase what they're showcasing to the best of their ability? And if they don't feel that they would, then that's when they inevitably would like to hold back. So it's understandable in that regard, but it's the prime reason why I don't interview anybody on slips.
When you're filming for Steam Locos and Profile, do you prefer to shoot on gala days when there's a lot of variety of locos and there's more chance of getting more, but you have to deal with crowds, or is it better to go on normal running days?
It really depends on what, where, when, and if. It's very much an individual thing. If there's a gala weekend where there's lots of engines which I would like the rushes for, and there's a chance that they would run on formations which may look a little more prototypical, then yes, I would go for them on gala days. But otherwise, it's quite nice to get them on normal operating days where there's not as many people around. And while I don't object to them from a safety and operational point of view, I do think that high visibility jackets can make a scene look far less prototypical and almost ruin the shot, making it look unusable from a cinematic point of view. So it really does depend on the type of engine that you're willing to film, really.
Have there ever been any episodes of slips that you've made that you would like to revisit?
No.
Once you're done with it, it's out of the door, it's done.
Yeah, although I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily done with the type of engine once I've finished shooting it. Just because I've finished a video about the Black Fives doesn't mean I then suddenly become bored of them once I've finished it. You know, I'd still enjoy them for the sake of what they are. Yeah, once you've spent nearly 4 years chasing both Britannias that kept going wrong every time you went near them, then you do become a little bit sick of trying to chase them all over the place and become less incentivized to chase them all over the place. Even though I'll always gawp every time one passes by because the noise they make. Oh, amazing. You know, I love a Britannia bark.
Do you think there's a danger that you're going to run out of locos to cover on Steam Locos and Profile?
If there is, it's not going to happen for several years yet. People have been asking me that more and more recently because I have announced plans that I would review types of engines which I have previously said I'm not that fond of, such as the Great Western Railway 5600 tank engines, which, don't get me wrong, I'm sure they were fine for what they did. It's just that me personally, I found other types of engine more fascinating, but that could be just me being me. I mean, it's immaterial anyway, because if it runs on Steam, I'll still take it, even if it is rubbish. But if I run out of types of engine in the UK, then I can always go abroad, I hope.
So what other kind of countries are you thinking of?
Well, my crew and I have already done a few trips to continental Europe and we'll gladly go back. We, in 2014, was our first trip to the Republic of Ireland. There was a group of lads from the Stradbally Woodlands Railway in County Laois who had seen the show and cottoned onto it, and one of them was begging to me for years before we went, come review our engine, because they've got one of the trio of 3-foot gauge well tanks that was built by Andrew Barclay for the Bortnamona Plantation, the Turf Development Board. And they were interesting in their own way that they were built as turf burners but didn't work as turf burners, yet all three of them have survived in preservation. And looking at it, I thought, okay, well, this looks slightly unusual. Why don't we go and do something there? And
is that one of the ones that was converted into Tom Rolls on the tail end?
That's right. Number one in the trio was converted into Tom Rolls, and then Stradbally have got number two in the trio, which is now named Regin, and number three in the trio, Shane, is stashed away in a shed up near Giant's Causeway. And then the second trip was 2017, where we crowdfunded a huge trip to Germany, specifically to review the Kriegslochs, or ended up being the Class 50s and 52s, because there's many types of Kriegslochs, more than just the 52s. While we were out there, we thought, well, we might as well do something on the Harz Mountain 2102s, because you can't be a railway enthusiast, go to Germany, and not do something on the Harz. It's just one of those go-to places, if not just for the locomotives, but for the whole setting, because it's gorgeous up there. It's absolutely beautiful.
It's an incredible system, the Harz. Like, it's a local, narrow-gauge, mostly steam-hauled railway.
Yes.
That still operates for the local populace.
Yeah. Okay, they have to do a lot of touristy things, touristy operations these days, and to help balance their books. And a lot of the normal services nowadays are largely hauled by diesel rail cars and diesel and electric trams. But there's still a large quantity of steam hauled services, particularly on the western section from Wernigerode up to Brocken Hill, because that's where all the tourists go to see the television tower and just the sheer view of the place. It's absolutely spectacular. But yeah, you're right. It is incredible that they're still running steam engines on a day-to-day commercial basis rather than a heritage basis.
What time of year did you go?
We went in September. We'd started crowdfunding the project around April, and we budgeted for about £3,000. And that was to cover absolutely everything. We actually ended up with about £1,000 or so over our projected budget, which was quite useful for us, because no, we didn't spend all the extra money on beer and strudel. When we budgeted in April, the exchange rate was much better than when we went in September. We got to Germany after 3 days filming in the Netherlands at the Volusia Stoomtrain Matschappe, which is about 15 miles north of Arnhem. We discovered on our first day in Germany that the exchange rate had actually dipped below 1 euro to the pound. So normally it's a euro, 5 euro, 6 cents. It dropped to about 95 cents to the pound. And oh God, you know. So that kind of messed around with us for the whole trip. So thank goodness that we ended up with that overrun. In 2019, there was another fairly impulsive trip, which I'm so glad that I made, to Poland. We tried to put at least one exclusive bonus film out on each DVD, if not sometimes two. And on those films, we tried to go for something that's either narrow gauge or unusual, so sites that generic UK steam enthusiasts wouldn't necessarily see. And that's why we usually go for narrow gauge or foreign material. We had initially planned to do something completely different on, as was then, Steam Locos in Profile Volume 5 coming out in 2019. But then in January 2019, the Volston Experience, who run the last operational standard gauge mainline steam hauled services in Europe, they announced that the way that Volston works is they obviously run the Volston Experience, which is the chance for you to have a footplate experience course on the main line. And they announced that at the end of 2019, they would end the footplate experience courses for one reason or another. And I thought, this could potentially mean the end of steam in Poland, so I thought I'd better go out there while I've still got the chance, and quickly cobbled things together. And although Sam and Adam were unable to go with me on that jaunt, I was able to completely do this on my own, under my own steam, so to speak, and with my own cash, because unlike other crowdfunding exploits, Poland was actually relatively cheap, because everything's so much cheaper out there. Lo and behold, I'm so glad I went, because Volston itself is an amazing place. You go into the depot thinking that it's going to be a heritage museum, but they're still running regular mainline steam hauled services, and you get a sense, just from looking at the lines of derelict engines around you, and then the handful of engines that are still in ticket there and still being serviced there, that it's almost like being in Lostock Hall or Rose Grove in 1967-68 and seeing the last few operational Black 5s and 8Fs on shed in a rundown state, clinging on to dear life and only being withdrawn from service once something major goes and
not being replaced.
Not being replaced, not being repaired or anything like that.
But that's what I was thinking. When you were saying about it might be, you know, coming to the end of steam, regular steam in Poland, you're almost getting an insight into what it was like for those videographers back in 67-68, you were trying to capture the last days of BR Steam.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You It's only when you see an OL-49 on shed that you realise what it must have been like to witness BR Steam on its last legs. Those really are the Black Fives and Eight Fs of their time. You know, they are the last of their kind. And if they were to go, then it'll be the end of standard gauge operational steam as we know it.
What they offer as an experience, are you running on commuter trains?
Yes. When I went out there, it was only two return services along a 30-mile stretch from Wolsztyn out to a place called Leszno, which is south of Poznan in southern Poland.
But still, 30 miles, that's longer than the West Somerset Railway in the UK.
Longer than the West Somerset, longer than the Welsh Highland Railway, I believe. So, you know, it's an incredible thing. And that's two return services a day, Monday to Friday. And then on the Saturday, they do two return services to the historic town of Poznan, which is 50-mile distance. You can have the footplate experience course over that week. And that means you could have anything up to between 600 and 800 miles of regular working steam, complete with grumbling commuters.
If you're not doing your job properly, I guess.
Well, yeah.
That leads me quite neatly into, what was the most rewarding episode to make?
Difficult to say, really, because they all come with their own experiences attached to them, but Poland was certainly a great experience.
And you were on your own then?
Yeah. Germany was certainly an amazing experience, even though it was quite stressful at times. But just watching the films back and seeing the results of all our efforts and all the long drives and so on that we went to just for the sake of that project, that was a great experience. I don't know, really. Every episode's quite rewarding in its own way, you know, having worked on it for several years and driven so many miles and walked so many miles more, and occasionally getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning just to go halfway up the country to get a few shots of one engine, only to come back that same night and not get to bed until 1 o'clock the following morning, is all the more rewarding when you look back at it and think, God, I did all that. And, you know, that can happen with any engine, really.
And what was the most challenging episode to make?
Most challenging to date has been the Britannias, rather infamously. I've gone on about it in previous escapades and previous talks and so on, but at the time, I had intended the Britannias to come out as episode 5 in the series, so that the way I'd initially planned the show out was episodes 1 to 6 were going to be something LMS Southern, LNER Great Western, British Rail and Industrial. So that way you get 6 of the standard gauge bases covered. Yeah, something for everyone, so then you move on to something else. But unfortunately, that ended up not happening. The A4s took longer to make than I initially expected, so that ended up being episode 5 instead of episode 4. While I had hoped that the Britannias would come out as the following episode, episode 6, both of the preserved examples kept breaking down, for want of a better word.
They've not had a great track record.
They haven't, unfortunately, and this isn't a gripe with anyone who may be listening to this who happens to work on the support crews of either of those locomotives, but it is unfortunate that any steam engine really is prone to going wrong, really.
I mean, just look at the problems Tangmere had.
Yes.
For a period of time, it seemed it was constantly in trouble.
Yeah, well, when I used to volunteer down at the Bluebell Railway, there was a similar running joke with our bully Pacific, Blackmore Vale. She was last in traffic between the years 2000 and 2008, and towards the end of those 8 years in ticket, she spent more of the year out of service than she did in. Even towards the start of those 8 years, there was a running joke amongst the fitters down at the workshops where, if World War III ever happens, the best thing you can do is to run and hide in Blackmore Vale's firebox. Because if a bomb drops, you have the satisfaction of knowing you've taken Blackmore Vale with you. So, I'm sorry, bullied fans, but they are very nice, but they are a pig to work on.
I think one of the things that certainly Paul Jarman at Beamish has pointed out over and over again is that for a long time, the preservation movement has, in effect, been using up the remaining life in these machines. To start with, they had to use the ones that they had available, which were often the ones that were still running. And certainly, I mean, if you look at a microcosm of that Talakvin, they used up the remaining life in Dolgoch, and it was knackered. I mean, it was time for total renewal by the time it was taken out of service. That we're seeing that a lot recently, and I know that's the driving force behind a lot of new build projects, but obviously, when you're trying to film these examples, you're having to deal with the fact that, you know, some of them are just old.
Very.
And some of them have been through two cycles of life, one in preservation and one in their working life. And, you know, steam engines are maintenance intensive.
They are, unfortunately. And you've even got to look at the youngest of the BR standards by 2020, and that's now 60 years old.
Yeah.
So
it's older than the locomotives it replaced.
That's true.
It's bizarre to think of that because you still think of it as quite a modern design. Have there been any episodes of Steam Locomotives in Profile that have been a surprise smash hit for you that have outperformed others?
The S160s was an interesting surprise. When I initially hinted that I was going to review the S160s, I had one person say to me, they were disposable junk, please don't review them because you're just going to make America look bad. And my thinking was, well, they may well have been a flawed design that were built on the cheap with a very short intended lifespan in mind, but they are still in abundance. They are still represented in railway preservation. I'm going to have to review them at some point.
Not only that, but their contribution to railway preservation has been incredible.
Yeah, you could say
look
that.
Look at Big Jim on Keith in Worth Valley.
Big Jim and 6046 has been certainly a big contributor to railway preservation in more recent years.
But it's like the austerities, they were built to a budget and they were disposable, but the sheer amount of them has helped our hobby so much. So you can criticise them all you want, but they still have made a valuable contribution.
And a lot of people do like them as a result of that. That was an interesting one to undertake because visually that wasn't just the locomotives puffing round doing this, that and whatnot with a couple of Mark 1s in tow. I went to the trouble of trying to show what they looked like in their working lives, pulling supply trains for the war effort. And it just so happens that in early 2016, a good friend of mine, Andrew Fowler, was running a photo charter at the Churnet Valley Railway with 6046 on a rake of goods wagons, which were loaded with what looked like crates of ammunition, represent crates of ammunition, plus an armoured car, some gun carriages, and the entourage was then accompanied by a group of local reenactors wearing World War II American Army uniforms, plus two Willys Jeeps and a 3-ton lorry, so looking like it really did in World War II when these guys were going to war. So visually that looked a lot more interesting, I feel, and certainly the fans liked it.
Certainly context helps quite a lot. I mean, you're never going to experience it fully, but you can get an insight into what this is supposed to look like back in the day.
Yeah, if you can get it looking somewhat like it used to look like, then people get a better idea of what it was actually like rather than just showing it on any old stock.
In the same vein, seeing an austerity on a train of Mark 1s is not the same as it trying to lug a huge train of 16-ton minerals over an incline.
That could be said about any industrial tank engines, really, because we really do tend to look at them out of context. Austerities these days tend to be used for almost as, like, my first locomotive, if you will, for some railways. Not necessarily all of them, but lots of railways started out with an austerity saddle tank on their books just to run trains.
And they've carried a lot of railways through harsh periods when, you know, all their XBR stock was out of service. I remember the South Devon almost relied on them almost exclusively for a few years.
Relied on Errol Lonsdale, yes.
And Sapper for a time, yeah.
Yeah. Spar Valley, closest to where I live, they've done quite well out of austerities over the years. Yeah, you could say that they are virtually unsung heroes of railway preservation, but because fewer heritage railways tend to run demonstration goods trains, and particularly demonstration goods trains which are made up with, I'm going to be rivet counter for a moment and say, the correct stock, in inverted commas, then getting them to look visually appealing can be more difficult than it can be if you were running a BR standard on BR stock because, you know, they're matching types and matching liveries, etc., etc.
Yeah, Tanfield and Foxfield are quite good at that, at running the correct stock with the locomotives.
Foxfield Bank particularly, that's a sight to behold.
Yeah. What is it about locomotives and trains in general that makes people quite obsessive and fascinated in them? What do you think is so appealing about these tools, these machines, that makes them so appealing?
With steam engines, I think there's an appeal to them no matter what they're doing. Especially from a visual point of view, you could look at a steam engine and it's always got something to say. And it's very easy to make steam engines look exciting on camera doing just any old sort of work. Cars have to be in chases to look exciting. Planes have to be doing crazy stunts to look exciting. Ships have to be doing a million miles an hour or sinking to look exciting. But with a steam engine, you could have it standing idle, whispering away, and it would have something to say. Or you could have it bolting along at 100 miles an hour, and it would still look amazing, you know, because you've got all those moving parts. You've got smoke and steam billowing from the chimney, and especially if it's on a cold day and, you know, the steam clings to the air for ages after it's gone past, and there's something about it that no other form of transport can provide from a visual point of view. And, you know, it's always got presence, no matter what it's doing. Railways tend to attract all sorts of people from all walks of life, and I think that's part of the fascination with railways in general. They've got so many layers that they can appeal to all kinds of people. You could go to a heritage railway and talk to two people, and they'll be from completely different walks of life. There's a chap who volunteers down at the Bluebell Railway who has no interest in railways whatsoever, but he volunteers at one of the stations because he likes mingling with the other people and the antics that go with it.
If you were able to go back and bring back an extinct loco class to review on Slips, what would it be?
I would love to do something about Stania's turbomotive, because there was, for me, that was a real lost opportunity to bring steam technology into the 21st century before the 21st century even came about. Until then, just about every steam locomotive going had been modelled on Stephenson's Rocket. It was reciprocating pistons which were directly connected to driving wheels and turning them. And it works very well for what it does, but there's only so much that you can really do with it, and there's only so much that you can get out of the technology. Whereas with the steam turbine, okay, it had its own range of problems, but if developed further and brought further into the mainstream, that could have been an interesting competitor to modern traction. And I think anyone who tries to go after Mallard's record now with a traditional reciprocating piston loco is doing it for the wrong reasons.
I think the T1 Society in America have that set in their sights.
I was trying not to bring them up, but yeah.
It doesn't count if you're wheel spinning. Anyway. Yeah,
sorry, he's saying it, not me, for the record. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, the turbomotive was standout, really. And the fact it was trialled on a mainline railway, and it wasn't completely the product of an external supplier, it was built in-house by the LMS, was very interesting. I thought that they were experimenting with such a different form of traction at that time.
Yeah, it was a fascinating bit of kit, and it's just unfortunate that spares were so hard to come by. You know, the turbine, I think, was built by Met Vickers, and had there been spare parts for turbines for that turbine in stock, then whenever it did go wrong, and it did go wrong, unfortunately, then it would have been a lot easier to replace those bits than having to go back to Met Vickers and say, we need this produced as soon as possible, can you supply blah blah blah. They just go to the back of their stores and pick up whatever was left in there. So it's just unfortunate that the engine was rebuilt into a more conventional locomotive and then tragically destroyed a few months later in the Karen Wilson disaster.
Yeah. Did any sound recording survive that loco?
Not that I know of.
That would be fascinating, I think, to find out what that was like to experience a turbine-driven engine. I think there's one in Sweden that's still functional. One turbine engine.
If there is, then I'd like to see it.
What is the main audience for steam locos in profile? When you've looked through the analytics and the demographics of people who watch it, what have you found it tends to be?
It's quite a mix, really. It's generally anybody from the age range of 13 to 17 right up to the 65s and over. There's less in between, but it tends to appeal to all ages. I never sought to seek out a specific demographic, a specific age range.
Is that because you don't want to pander to a certain demographic?
Yeah, because I think pandering is the worst thing that anybody can really do. As soon as you chase after one minority of likes, you then alienate the majority of people who might actually be interested in it. So best to appeal to as many people as you possibly can and, you know, hope that they cotton onto it and like what you do.
Is it mostly a UK audience?
Yes, it's mostly UK audience, although said that the American audience is quite big as well. About 28-29% of my regular audience are from the US. There's about 55% that usually tune in from the UK, and then the rest are obviously other countries elsewhere. Australia and Canada usually level peg at about 7-8%. Depending on the month and depending on what I tend to put out.
But that's actually a more interesting split than I thought. I thought that it would be far more than 55% because the subject matter is so often British steam locos, but it shows that they do have an appeal worldwide.
Yeah. A lot of Americans have come forward to me and said, "You are the only reason why I've taken any interest in UK locomotives, and it's, you know, it's just nice that you can showcase them to such an extent, so thanks for that." And, you know, I feel really happy that they've been able to get that something out of it. It's great.
What about in terms of gender split? Is it mostly a male audience?
It is mostly a male audience, although I've had quite a lot of women come up to me and, you know, thank me for similar reasons, and, you know, it's just nice in that regard.
When you talk about appealing to as many people as possible, what I've found that a lot of people do quite often is appeal to a base level of knowledge of zero. Do you find that quite difficult to do? And do you have a certain level of assumed knowledge that you just assume the audience will already know before they tune in?
Yes, I tend not to underestimate my audience's intelligence because, again, that's a very easy thing to do and it's a very dangerous thing to do, similar to pandering. If you dumb down the level of information that you provide to, this engine runs on steam, you can tell this because of the steam coming out of it, it runs on rails, it runs on coal and water, etc., etc., people already going into a show about railways would already know that anyway. So there's a lot of terminology which I tend to use which I would tend to assume that the audience would know already. So things like pony trucks and
reversers
and regulators and injectors, etc., etc., etc. Most railway enthusiasts, I feel, would tend to know these things already going in. So trying to explain these things over and over again can look a little bit degrading, I feel. So
it can also alienate the people you're actually trying to appeal to. If you're making something that's aimed at other people like yourself, who are very much into a topic, doing something that is just coming in at a base level and trying to explain to Joe Public what something is can switch them off.
Yeah, I agree.
Where do you pitch your level of assumed knowledge? And how do you figure that out? Is it based on your own experiences?
A lot of it's based on my own experiences, but a lot of it's based on just being connected with other people who work on heritage railways and have worked on steam engines in the past. I feel that when I started the show, I wanted to appeal specifically to the general steam enthusiast because I feel that they were being shortchanged effectively in terms of mainstream media as far as steam locomotives are concerned. But what I didn't anticipate was that friends of mine gotten onto the show who would otherwise have not been interested in trains at all.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Even after the first couple of episodes, people came forward to me saying that they had no interest in steam engines whatsoever, and yet they found what I was producing more engaging than what they would find on mainstream television.
That kind of positive feedback and affirmation that you're doing something right in bringing somebody into your pet topic, I think, is very important because it's very easy to shut people out by use of jargon.
Yeah.
And confusing terms. If you assume too much knowledge, sometimes you can shut a lot of people up. But the fact that people who weren't previously into this topic got into it through that shows that it can be a doorway, and not treating people as idiots, I think.
Yeah, essentially. Although you say that I must be doing something right. I've no idea what that something right is, because initially, I didn't plan this with generic audiences in mind, and yet somehow they're slowly cottoning onto it. It comes back to what I said earlier about providing just about the right level of relevant information and not going into too much detail. So I tend to draw the line at things like shed allocations and the number of rivets on a tender and so on and so forth, because that stuff, you can find that information out. But for the majority of people who might be watching it just because they're looking for a gentle piece of escapism from the real world, they may not necessarily want to get too far into that just for a 15-20 minute video. If they want to find out something like that, then they can always go and find the drawings of a locomotive and look it up that way.
I think for that kind of thing, the written word is actually more powerful because...
Agreed.
When you're trying to memorise figures like that, I certainly struggle with large numbers.
It's easy to blind people with information and too many facts, and sometimes I do tend to do that, but at other times, people say that I don't provide quite enough information and I tend to leave certain bits out.
What's the general sentiment been around episodes of Steam Lookers and Profile, good and bad?
I would stand by what I said years ago in that the key to Slips' success over the years has been that the fan base is incredibly loyal. They have supported me through thick and thin and, you know, they're just all amazing like that. It's nice that I can go to a heritage railway and the odd person stops me here and there saying, "Oh, I really like what you do, Chris. Thanks a lot for making it," and things like that. And That, I thought, would be as far as it would ever get if it ever got to that stage, but people have come forward to me and told me that it has effectively influenced them to get involved in railways. You know, I've had people come up to me over the years saying things like, oh, it helped me through this really difficult part in my life, and I've come to your channel for escapism, and it's just been great to be able to switch off to your work. And I've had others come forward saying, thank you for doing what you do, because it's got me into the railway industry or influenced me to get involved in my local heritage railway. There's a particular favourite story of mine from when we went over to Ireland. The guy who was firing the engine there, who was a chap called Alan Curran, he had started volunteering at Stradbally around the time that Steam Locos in Profile began to air. And at that time, he was 16 years old and just about ready to turn his back on railways, because he was getting bullied at school for it and didn't have many friends that he could really interact with about it. But having seen Slips and, you know, gotten involved with Stradbally and a few other railways in Ireland, he became more interested in it, more keen in it. And after about 5 years, he then passed out as a driver at Stradbally. And in doing so, he had become the youngest qualified steam engine driver in both parts of Ireland, the Republic and Northern Ireland. He was only 21 when he passed his test, and he said to me shortly after he passed that if it wasn't for Slips showing him that it was okay to be in your 20s and really into steam in the 21st century, then he wouldn't have necessarily taken it up and he wouldn't be where he is today.
I think this is something that's a common theme with stuff we've got, is about representation.
Yeah.
So people saying online, look, there are other people like me who like the stuff that I do. It's okay to like the stuff, even if my peers in my immediate social groups don't like it and aren't interested in it. Certainly for me, when I was growing up, if I'd had the online resources that there are now, I might have stayed with it and not had, you know, 10 years off. I think that having that representation is so important. And if we are to continue the preservation movement and interest in railways, that, I think, is crucial.
I think you're right. The ways of getting people interested in steam are changing for better or worse. You know, you can't get people interested in trains just from, oh, it's something to do at weekends, and it's far easier to play with a smartphone than it is to go and get your hands dirty on a Bully Pacific down the Bluebell, for instance. A lot of heritage railways in the tens, if you'd like to call it that, between 2010 and 2019, have struggled to get new people in for one reason or another. A lot of railways everywhere are struggling for volunteers because of the age thing. Younger people tend to value their time a lot more now than they certainly did when I started volunteering in year 2000, when I was only 13. They may look at something which doesn't pay, which has little rewards beyond saying, oh, you're getting involved with something, or, oh, I've restored that. You know, if you've worked on an engine for 10, 20 years or so, I did that. And they may just look at it on face value and think, well, why would I give up my time for free?
I think it's also a problem that's come up before, where the age discrepancy between the young people who want to do it and the people who are there and have been doing it for years is so large that there's very little common ground between them. And certainly conversation topics outside of trains and railways might be quite difficult for them because they don't have the same reference points.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
More representation, as we say, is so important. And saying these people are in between you and people at the top end of the experience spectrum, they can relate more to what you like. We need that middle ground in order to be able to pull people in and say, this is okay, it's fine to like this stuff. I think that social attitudes are changing a little bit, and mm-hmm. and geekery, for want of a better word, and enthusiasm about topics is more well rewarded these days and lauded than certainly when you and I were growing up, when it was seen as something that was to not be respected unless it was football, and that was seen as a source of derision. Was it like that for you?
It was growing up at school. I was one of the few people in my school who had any sort of interest in railways. A lot of people, certainly when I was growing up, did tend to take the mickey out of anyone who liked trains, thinking it was a very geeky thing and, you know, completely uncool and mocked for this, that and whatnot. And it's interesting, when I was growing up in the late 90s, early 2000s, the main representative that we had for anything heritage in that regard was the late, great Fred Dibner. Okay, audiences of all ages could connect to him in some way or another, but the fact remains that he wasn't a young man when he was presenting his shows. If younger audiences can connect to a younger person or more sort of middle-aged person, 20s, 30s, 40s person, a lot more than they could with someone who was in their 60s, unless they saw them as like a grandfather figure. And I think if you can connect to someone with a more personable approach that's closer to their age group, then they will be able to connect more because they identify with them a lot more instead of want to aspire to be them a lot more.
Absolutely. It's like, I too can do that. If someone's only 5 years older than you, they can't have had 60 years more experience.
Because nobody can choose when they were born.
Do you volunteer? Do you have time to volunteer?
I don't have as much time to volunteer now as I used to. I used to volunteer at the Bluebell and Kentney Sussex Railways. Nowadays, I do manage to make a weekend trip a year to the Stradbally Woodlands Railway in Ireland. I volunteer there as a pass guard, and I am training to be a fireman, but how long it'll be before I pass out as a driver, I'll probably be dead before I ever get that chance. Only the people who supervise me on the engine will be able to tell me how I'm doing, so I'm not going to say how good I am or not, because I've no idea.
What was your experience of volunteering?
My experience of volunteering at the Bluebell in Kentley, Sussex, was usually as a fitter in the loco works. Growing up at that age, as a teenager, I was fascinated by mechanical things, and I love finding out how things work, and I love getting my hands dirty. So I think it's far more interesting to learn about something by taking it apart and putting it back together again than it is just to write about it and do essays and sat down exams about it. I've always felt that interactive practical learning is more interesting than theoretical learning. A chance to work on steam locomotives when I was much younger was, for me, it was just a dream job. Anyone who's thinking about volunteering, it is a good thing to do. It does get you out of the house at the end of the day. But also it helps you to mingle with people of a like mind and, you know, of similar interests. Although there may always be some bad apples at every railway you go, unfortunately, that's just the case with life in general. For the minority of them you may come across, the majority of them are still in it for the same reasons that you are, effectively. So it's very easy to be put off railway preservation.
Or by the age divide, do you mean?
Yeah, age divide.
So not having the common ground and not having the shared experiences.
Yeah,
if you could go back in time and talk to the young Chris Eden Green and give him some advice to help him get through that kind of thing, what would you say?
Don't let the bastards grind you down. If I could talk to younger me now, then I would try and say to him that chances are you will come across these people in life, but try not to be put off by them. Yeah, if you are interested in volunteering anywhere, then it's worth at least having a go at it, just to say that you can do it. Because at the end of the day, railway preservation does need younger blood coming forward.
Or to die out.
Yeah.
Which would be sad for everyone, I think. I think that one of the best ways of preserving something is to show it working. And to give somebody the actual 4D experience of being there. Because we work in video, and we know that it's great to get across visuals, but to smell it and feel it is something else, I think. And something you unfortunately don't get with museums. Do you have a personal preference on stuffed and mounted locos in museums versus... Do you have a particular point of view on those versus working ones?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting subject that often comes up, which I try to skirt around without offending anybody. I always think that whoever owns the locomotive, it's their decision at the end of the day, and it's their decision to be respected at the end of the day. But I would make a point in saying that if you saw an animal stuffed in the Natural History Museum, it would be a very different experience to seeing it alive in the wild. It's the same creature, but you're looking at it from a different point of view, and
you experience it in a way.
Yeah, you experience it in a different way. And it's the same with steam engines, really. A steam locomotive that's all cold in a dark part of the National Railway Museum doesn't look anywhere near as appealing for me, and for a lot of people, I'm sure, than it would if it was charging up a heritage line at 25 miles an hour. If you get to see it and smell it, and if you ever get the chance to work on it, then it can change your perspective of that locomotive. Mm. I was talking to a friend of mine who fires down at the Swanage Railway last year, in 2019, and she was telling me how a lot of people down there were interested about the London South Western Railway T3 entering service when that eventually happens, because to the best of anyone's knowledge, no one has any idea what that loco is going to perform like, because it last ran at a time when hardly anybody who's alive could remember it. And even if they were alive then, they may not necessarily remember what the London Southwestern Railway T3 was like. So is it going to perform like the T9? Is it going to perform more like the M7 or the Standard 4 or anything like that? No one really knows for sure.
I think that's what makes projects such as the Bloomer, the LNWR Bloomer and things so interesting, is that I don't think there's any singles apart from Rocket and Planet running in UK preservation.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
And certainly not on Preserved Railways hauling a train of Mark 1s or whatever it might be.
No, just demonstration runs, because that's seemingly all that they're able to do.
Yeah, and that mid-range of locomotives between the early years where we've got lots of replicas and, you know, the late BR years where we've got lots left over, thank you, Di Woodham.
Thanks, man.
There's a missing link there, and I think that will be fascinating to see some of these replicas that are built to the original specification. There's a Great Central One Plan number 567, mm-hmm. Which is going to be very interesting to compare to the other stock they have running on the Great Central. I mean, compare that to, say, you know, a Black 5.
Yes.
Or something. What's it going to perform like? What's it going to be like?
Who knows? I don't think anyone would know for sure until they put the fire in the belly and send it up the line. So,
all that being said, I do think there is a place for museums, and I do appreciate the work they have done in preserving stuff. Because, for example, like you say about the T3,
mm-hmm.
that wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them. So the people who did stuff and mount it have, in a sense, conserved it for us.
Yes.
And enabled us to then fire it up again. I feel sad when it's a case of something going away with never any plans to put it back into service.
I mean, don't misunderstand. I think that I don't have anything against railway museums as an entity. You know, they do what they do, and they do it very well. And they give a perspective on history that most other places wouldn't otherwise give. And credit where it's due, they do keep the majority of their collection undercover. So in that sense, that is preserving it for future generations to come and witness.
And crucially, on display. Absolutely, not hidden away.
It's very much a public collection. You know, they very rarely hide stuff away when nobody can see it, which would be a very different story than if it was all put in the hands of a private collector, you know. Imagine Mallard being given to a private collector who didn't want to show it to anybody.
Yeah, or being horrible. I think there's a lot of problems with museums that, like, have one item of stock. There's a 1400 class that's in a museum in Tiverton, and it's their only locomotive, but that means it's never seen in context with anything else.
Yeah, and may never be seen in context with anything else, may never run again. The number of times I've heard people say, let's liberate it from that museum, is amazing.
Like the Titfield Thunderbolt.
Oh, if only.
Talked a lot about young blood, mm-hmm. people coming into the hobby. Do you think there are enough people coming into the hobby at the moment to sustain it?
There's more coming into the hobby now than there was when I started volunteering. And I think in that regard, yes, there is enough coming in. But I think the big problem is sustaining that level of young blood coming in. Because as we've already discussed, it's getting harder to influence younger people to come in, to encourage younger people to come in. So it's a matter really of finding that level of encouragement and then sustaining that level of encouragement. And you can't really do that just by doing the same thing over and over again. Unfortunately, you have to change it up every couple of years to, cliche term coming up, get with the times effectively, because as much as we like to think that railway preservation is all about conserving what we had before, the attitudes of what we had before are not necessarily useful as a part of that.
Do you think that to attract new people, we need to change the angle of how we're approaching them?
Difficult for me to say. Certainly the way that it's advertised can be stepped up, because the way that it's advertised on social media nowadays is a great tool for getting new people in, because that's where most young people are nowadays. But how we go around actually showcasing how we encourage a more steady flow of volunteers coming in is a question which I don't think anybody could really answer, because it's forever changing. The answers, there's new questions being brought up every year, and we're forever trying to find answers to those questions.
If we take the opposite point of view, those of people who are in railway preservation might not be so well receptive to younger people coming in. If we try and put ourselves in their shoes, I wonder if it's a little bit like, here's an example. I've worked in film production for a while. I used to do quite a lot of auditions, as in where I'd have to film people doing auditions, and it used to really frustrate me because you're watching someone do something for the first time over and over and over again. You get to the end of the day and you're like, why aren't they getting any better? They've done this over and again because you've been watching different people do it for the first time. Do you think that there's an element of that where, because you have such a high turnover, people have to try it out in order to find out if they like it or not? Do you think that because you have that turnover of people coming in, that they are making the same mistakes again? To the people who have been there a while, the way they see it is they're making mistakes all the time, but in fact it's different people making the same mistake.
How indeed?
So if we put ourselves in their shoes, how do you think the railway preservation movement should encourage its older volunteers or more established volunteers to accept that newbies will make mistakes and they will be naive? Is that by education? Is that courses? Is that having a middleman?
I think it's got to be a combination, because you can't judge the older generation of enthusiasts by one person, because the attitudes of one older person will be very different to the attitudes of the next older person. You know, some will be more open-minded than others. Some will have different views and different ways of doing things to others, in much the same way that they do with politics or religion or anything that ends up dividing people.
That as railway managers, even volunteer managers, they have to keep their eyes open for this kind of thing. If they spot that somebody is perhaps not being as accommodating to less experienced people, I think they have to be careful about who they pair up with who and make sure that there's someone there who they know will be supportive to the younger people who have been in that situation not that long before. Certainly for me, as a volunteer in my various forms over the years, I found that some people, they will get frustrated when you make mistakes. Mm-hmm. Other people will be very accepting. And I think if you were just exposed to the people who get quite frustrated, you would be put off. Because understandably, they grumble about it. And I think that's a very human condition. And actually, you have to arrest yourself before you do that. Some people don't necessarily have that kind of self-awareness, or they're just tired. The people who get you through are the people who support you, even when you're making mistakes.
Yeah. I mean, I will always stand by that if someone does make a mistake, the thing to do is not to ridicule them and put them down for it. It's to point out where they made the mistake and how they can improve on that. You know, it's not necessarily an ageism thing, but I have seen this a lot in railway preservation, whereby someone makes one mistake and then they're forever branded as that bloke who's made that mistake or that mess up, and suddenly everything becomes their fault, regardless of whether or not they were involved in anything that went wrong.
I think that's also a fine line between being ribbed for something in a sort of joshing manner.
Yeah.
Could be interpreted as bullying, depending on the person. I think, you know, it's the same as treating any human being. Understand their point of view. Yes. Understand and try and look out for when they might be getting upset about it, because you can't afford to lose them. I think that's my main point, is you cannot afford to upset people anymore. I think we need to band together.
First thing I learned at the Bluebell was, if you depend on someone, you can't afford to piss them off. And I think that's spelled out rather too plainly and benignly at one point in the Titfield Thunderbolt, the scene where they're refilling with water for the first time and, you know, Dan is caught poaching by the vicar and suddenly the engine overflows. They start to argue with each other and Dan walks off and suddenly next thing you hear is, come back, we need you. You look back at the Reverend and he's looking on in despair thinking, oh God, the railway's going to close if Dan doesn't come round. And that's when Dan comes back and says, all right, long as we understand each other, and they kiss and make up, and before you know it, the train's on the way again. Weirdly, that's almost like a warning from history that came sort of 50 years before it became really super relevant. 50, 60 years before it became super relevant.
Prophetic, almost.
Yeah.
I'd never thought about that before. That's actually a really good reference, yeah. Well, you know, the template for all railway preservation should surely be the Titfield Thunderbolt anyway.
Yeah.
And the reason I talk about railway preservation is because you've been travelling around to all of these sites, because you've had this extensive experience of heritage railways over many, many years, that's why I wanted your input on this, because I think that you've spoken to a lot of people at a lot of different railways. You've obviously had to get permissions to film. If you had to say, in order to help people like you who are making basically promotional content for railways as a whole, what should Preserve Railways do?
Be more accepting of one another. You know, at the end of the day, we all like railways to some degree. We're all in it for more or less that reason. Yes, we're going to have our differences over the finer details, like which railways we prefer or which coaching stock looks better behind which engine, what livery's best, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes we may have our differences from an operational or a practical point of view. But at the end of the day, to discriminate one railway from another can be unhealthy. I won't name any particular railways that may be seen as guilty of this, but there is still a fair bit of cliqueiness over one railway won't talk to another because one railway sees themselves better than the other. On a face value term, you may have a point in saying that some railways can offer a quote-unquote better experience than others, but it's not necessarily better, it's just a different experience. But it's different, but it's still offering the same level of experience. It's still offering a piece of history, a piece of how Britain used to be, or how any country used to be that ran railways, ran steam engines. And for that reason, it would help if more railways got along, I feel.
And then in terms of your experience of working with Heritage Railways, which ones have stuck out to you as being particularly helpful to you and what you're making?
Didcot Railway Centre have always been really good to me. Even quite early on, they recognised the power of visual art and saw steam locos in profile effectively as a viral tool for them to promote their locomotives and them as a site. Because a fair bit of the first couple of episodes were shot at Didcot. You know, there were segments from the castles and the 5700s and the Southern U-Boats film shot at Didcot. They effectively said to me, right, well, any time that you want to come along, just tell us which engine you want to film and we'll happily line it up for you on this road or whatever. And we'll just let you have free reign. And that was really kind of them. And, you know, anyone from Didcot who's listening to this, thank you very much. You've been amazing. But, you know, lots of other railways have become more and more accommodating over the years. Like, ones off the top of my head include Stradbally, the Vale of Ryde all took us in when we did a special on their locomotives, the Thuringer Eisenbahn Museum in Germany, where we did the PTCs for the Kriegslok films. They actually lined a 50 and a 52 up side by side specifically for us.
That's incredible when people go out of their way to help you.
Yeah.
Isn't that so nice?
You know, it's lovely. It's amazing to think that Railway Preservation can do that. But that kind of comes back to what I was saying. They were all in it for the same reason. So it's nice that they're happy to help other railway enthusiasts out in that regard and go to those lengths. Not that they necessarily have to, but it's nice of them to do so. There's loads of other railways that I could highlight in that regard, but I've only got so many fingers on my hands and I can't really... I'll run out of fingers as soon as I list them all off, but yeah.
And you don't want to exclude any as well.
No, exactly. You know, they're all great for their own reasons.
Absolutely. What advice would you give to people about how to deal with criticism of their work online?
I think you've got to be very open with criticism and you've got to learn to be able to take the rough with the smooth, obviously, and learn to filter out what's genuinely useful and what's just being pedantic for the sake of being difficult. I get a lot of people who say that they don't like certain elements of the show. Like, I've had people over the years saying that the music that I compose for the show is unnecessary or superfluous or, you know, ruins the overall feel of the film and becomes distracting. But I would make a point in saying that the music is there to add an extra element to the show, an extra layer. So there are those who would point things out because either I sometimes get facts wrong and I'm happy to cop to my mistakes.
How do you deal with getting facts wrong?
The most adult way, really, is just to put your hands up and say, I'm sorry, I'll cop to my mistakes, because some of them are genuinely silly. Like, I did an editorial about trains which had been built by film studios for use in films such as The Lone Ranger and TV shows like Hell on Wheels and so on. And I'd shown a picture of an American 440 which looked like it was from the Civil War, but it was actually built a lot later than that, late 20th century. And on face value, I thought it was a genuine American 440, but then a few people in the comments pointed out that it wasn't, and I just thought, whoops, oh yeah, so it is. So it was built much, much later. Sorry about that, chaps.
YouTube doesn't really allow editing within videos that have already been uploaded, so how do you get across a correction?
I just have to come to it in the comments and say I'm sorry about that. If I were to have the luxury of chopping a bit out and then adding a new bit in, then I would do that on the spot. I don't like the idea of uploading a video and then suddenly taking it down for the sake of correcting the smallest thing. I think it's just a lot easier to own up to it, say, sorry, I got that wrong, I know I did, and then just move on, because sometimes the little things are just not worth sweating over.
Railway enthusiasts are passionate people. Sometimes some things can come across perhaps not in the tone that they should. Sometimes criticism can be quite harsh. For young creators who want to make railway videos and face criticism, what advice would you give to them to turn ordinary criticism like YouTube comments and things like that into something constructive and positive?
I'd say just try to take everything in as you read it, but then try to take a step back from everything and think to yourself, okay, well, all of this is coming in. Is there anything that I can do, not necessarily to counteract it, but anything that I can take on board and use in effect to improve on what I've created in the past? And the key thing is to separate listening to that advice to taking that advice on board. If you took everybody's advice on board, then you are effectively pandering to your audience, because you're doing exactly what they tell you, and you then don't end up as a creator, you end up like a puppet. You know, you can take all criticism on board, but you don't necessarily have to enact it if you think it doesn't suit what you're trying to go for.
So what you're talking about is contextualizing criticism.
Yeah.
So what do I need to filter out? How is this useful to me? For you, how was that process? When people were critical of your work, not point out inaccuracies as such, but was there anything that people said that made you think, oh, maybe I can make this product better?
To start with, I was very limited, more limited on how much information I would provide. I asked around the middle of 2014 what improvements to the show would people like to see, and the most I got from people was, we just like more information. And I thought, okay, then, well, I'll try and provide more information if I can, but all the while try to not provide absolutely everything.
You've talked a little bit about being recognised, and as you're putting yourself out there as a presenter, your face is in front of the camera, and does that happen quite a lot?
It happens a lot more than it certainly did when I was starting out. It took about 3 episodes before people, complete strangers, began stopping me at railways and saying, you're that guy from Steam Localizing Profile, aren't you? And I am still getting used to it.
Do you think you'll ever get used to it?
I hope that I don't, actually, because the moment that you do get used to it, I think, is the moment that you start to let fame go to your head, and that's when you really start to become a bit of a head, I think. Heaven forbid I ever get to that stage. Certainly if I do come across as ego inflated, that's not the intention, and I am sorry if I do come across like that sometimes, but you know, it's very rare for me these days not to get stopped at the Heritage Railway whenever I'm out shooting or even just visiting some places with friends or with my girlfriend and so on. People say to me, oh, you're Chris Eden Green, aren't you? I love what you do. Thanks a lot for doing it. And things like that. And, you know, I always make a point in saying that it's nice. It's just nice to know that somebody likes it, because it's better, I think, to be unassuming while at least putting your face out there so that people can identify you as being part of that show or that project or that film. But it's a difficult thing to balance, you know.
How hard was it to, and I think a lot of people have the problem of putting themselves in front of the camera for fear of being judged. How was it for you? How did you get over that?
The build-up is always the most difficult thing. I remember hearing an interview with Francis Rossi, the lead singer of Status Quo, years and years ago. The first gig he ever did in 1962 with his first incarnation of the band, he wouldn't go on until a certain member of the audience turned up, who was the mother of the bass player, who was really good to him at that time. And even now he says that before he goes on, that's always the worst part. It's only when you get into the opening chords of the first song that you suddenly see the audience interact, and you're away, you don't think about it until it's all over.
Do you still get nerves about going on camera?
Sometimes I do, but it's becoming more second nature to me now, because I just accept the fact that I'm going to mess up at some point during the recording process, and it's best just to get on with it and not dwell on that, you know. The beauty about pre-recording stuff over live performance is that with live performance, once you fluff, you've got to somehow recover yourself from that fluff, and there's no ignoring the fact that you fluffed up. Whereas if you pre-recorded stuff, you can always do another take if you're not happy with the first one. So it's helpful in that regard, but there is still that worrying sensation of, well, if I present a line in a way that I'm not entirely happy with, but I go with it anyway, how's it going to look when I look back at it in 6 months' time and think to myself, oh God, I can't watch myself saying that, or something like that, you know.
How much do you go back and look at your old work?
Not as often as I do when I'm editing the thing, because I think anyone who spends months or even years on a project editing it away and forever tweaking it to try and get it that little bit better day after day, night after night, once they've finished it and got it out there, they probably don't want to see it again because they're sick and tired of seeing it throughout the production process. But I make a point of watching full episodes back every couple of months to see initially how far I've come, but also to see what I used to do which I can keep on doing, or what I used to do which I need to improve on, sort of thing. And because I'm always striving to improve the show in whatever way I can, whether it be newer cameras, different shots, faster editing, slower editing, more facts, less facts, more entertaining bits, less entertaining bits, more hyperbole, less hyperbole, more history, less history, whatnot. It's a never-ending process, really. And you can never get rid of what you've done in the past.
Would you say that you're your own worst critic?
Yes.
How do you deal with trying not to be too harsh on yourself?
Just accept the fact that you're going to get things wrong, and you know you've got a chance to correct those things later on down the line, and you know you are still human at the end of the day. You're going to make mistakes in anything you do, really, be it film, television, or just life in general. It's not about being the best filmmaker out there. It's just about being as good a human being in general as you can be.
In terms of the growth of your channel, you say it's been a steady process. Were there any bursts of activity? Has it been up and down, or has it been a pretty consistent rate of new subscribers coming on board?
It's been a pretty consistent rate over the years. I think when Steam Locos in Profile went on air, I had about 400 subscribers. That quickly grew to 1,000 in about 2 years. Well, as of the start of 2020, it was just coming up to 12,000. It could always be a better growth, but then it could always be a worse growth. So I try not to dwell on it too much.
There's such a saturation of content online now, especially on YouTube. The way they promote stuff is changing all the time. How do you get quality, curated content to break through and be noticed?
I think it's a matter of just being different. If you set out to try and be like somebody else, then you're always going to be compared to that somebody else. There's a million and one videos on YouTube which are just montages of railway activity, of trains passing, cameras at various locations along the line, and some of them are admittedly shot better than others, and some are better quality than others, and some have smoother pans and smoother shots than others. But at the end of the day, they are all still railway montages of generic railway activity.
There's certainly a place for that, but yeah, standing out from the crowd is going to be difficult.
Yeah, so which is why it's important, really, to come up with something which can be identified as you, you know, whether it be a short review about a certain type of locomotive or complete and utter history of this station or that railway, whatnot. If you can come up with something that nobody else is doing and then get it out to as many places as you possibly can, as many social media outlets as possible, all the Facebook groups, all the relevant feeds, then that would help your growth, effectively.
Have you ever been tempted? Well, there's a lot of talk, especially on YouTube at the moment, about the algorithm, which is the automated way in which YouTube promotes its own videos, what it selects to show to people. Have you been tempted to game or obey the algorithm in some way before? Because I think that the way that YouTube content has changed over time, in the way that they promoted different videos, they started going for longer form stuff. Then they went through a period of having quite nice, tight, well-made stuff to being, okay, just put lots of stuff out there. Let's get as much content as possible. Let's make it longer so we can put more ads up alongside it. Let's promote those videos more. How tempted have you been to mimic that kind of work? Or have you stuck to your guns?
I've always stuck to my guns because to this day, I have never understood YouTube's algorithm. It's just completely baffling.
YouTube doesn't understand YouTube's algorithm.
Yeah.
Hail the algorithm. How have you found that in order to compete with channels where people do one takes, they leave all the mistakes in, etc., etc., Those are quite popular on YouTube at the moment, and I think there's a place for that as well. How do you stay competitive with stuff that takes longer to make, but is more tightly edited?
I try not to think too much about any potential competition, but I think it helps in a way that to this day, nobody else has really tried to imitate Slips. I've had fans from America who have come forward to me over the years and said, yeah, we've put a team together and we'd like to film Slips for you, and but still have it as your thing. But then it's not necessarily Slips if I'm not the one who's making it. It's just someone else's project, and they really shouldn't be calling it Steam Locos in Profile because that's my intellectual rights. Although they've come forward to me and made that offer to me, they haven't actually gone out and done it, in effect. I suppose you could say the nearest competitors, although I use the term very loosely because they do very different things, are Jeff Marshall and Laurie Rose, but they do very different forms of railway content, you know.
I was going to come on to this because I was wondering what you thought of shows like Laurie Goes Loco, which are, I mean, he's almost a new kid on the block in that terms. His channel's blown up quite recently.
Mm.
He does do a variety of content, mostly automotive, but also with a variety of railway content in as well. He is doing Steam Loco reviews in a different way, I would say. And what's your point of view on your style versus his?
Well, I think my style covers a lot more of the background of certain locomotive designs and a lot more of the strengths and weaknesses. Laurie's very much more of a hands-on kind of bloke. He actually goes out and drives the things and demonstrates what they're like, kind of like a proper Top Gear road test in that regard. Whereas I just show them puffing around, but then I talk about them every so often. But I try to give as much background information on the loco types as possible.
Where Laurie's is a road test, I guess you could say yours is more of a featurette.
It's kind of you to think of it like that. But it's a very different kind of railway content, very different form of railway content.
Do you think that your channels compete with each other or complement each other?
I've never seen Laurie as a competitor, even though I've only latched onto him relatively recently, as I'm sure lots of people have. I think what he does is very different to what I do, and therefore we can't really be seen as competitors. Just, it's nice to have more shows about trains than there would have been otherwise. You know, it's like a lot of people compare Top Gear these days to the Grand Tour. They're two very different kinds of show. If you were to ask James May about what he thinks of Top Gear now, he says he quite likes it because it's nice to have more than one show about cars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's nice to have more than one show about trains.
I think it would be a cold person to want a monopoly on it.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want a monopoly on it.
Have the changes in YouTube policy and promotion had an impact on your channel over the years?
Difficult to say, really. YouTube comes up with new and potentially dangerous laws every year or every other year, be they SOPA, be they Article 13. Recently, COPPA has reared its ugly head and affected a lot of channels. Because the danger with COPPA is that if your stuff could be seen as child-friendly, then you need to list it as such. But on the other hand, if you do so, then that can have an impact on your ad revenue. If you're out to monetize your videos, then
can't have comments as well.
Yeah, can't have comments, can't even have likes and dislikes from what I've noticed. On the other hand, if you don't list it as child-friendly, even though it evidently is, you could still be done for it, so you can be stung either way.
I think it's going to be certainly a learning process that we're going to have to go through, all of us as content creators, in order to get through this thing. I think a lot of these things are knee-jerk reactions in some cases, and there can often be people who lose out from that.
Unfortunately, yeah, there's always going to be a case of the strong and the weak. The weak are going to fall by the wayside. The ones with a big enough following will get through it somehow.
Yeah, and you just got to make sure that you're protected in the meantime.
Yeah.
Who would win in a fight, Churchwood or Gresley?
Trevithick, because without him, neither of those two would have existed.
Do you get asked to do other spin-off shows from Steam Locos in Profile?
The number of people who have asked me to do a Diesel Locos in Profile.
What's your reasons for not doing Diesel Locos in Profile?
Because it's the same reason that Fred Dibner wouldn't present Top of the Pops. It just wouldn't work, you know. I think if you're going to present a show about anything, it's got to be something that you're really interested in. Otherwise, your efforts come across as forced and unnatural, and you look as if you're doing it for a paycheck and not for actually showcasing the subject matter in as good a way as it could be, in the way that it deserves. As little as I care for diesels and electrics, I do appreciate that they do have their place in history. They are part of the story of railway technology. So to do without them altogether would indeed be a great shame. But to get me to present shows about them, it would just be... it would make me look and feel really uncomfortable. Because I've little to no interest in them whatsoever.
I think that's a really important point, is that in order to be very good at something, you need to be passionate about it. You need to be interested in it. And to force yourself to like and be enthused about something is just not going to have a good result.
Mm.
What future do you see for steam locos and profile and the channel as a whole? Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you'd like to do?
There's lots of locomotive classes that I haven't done yet, which I'd really like to do. There's more overseas stuff that I really would love to do, and people have been begging for me to do for years. You know, every other video people are saying, when will you come and do slips in America? And I've looked at America every year since 2015, and every time I do, the prices go up by about $2,000, you know. So in order to get there would be a massive crowdfunding project. A similar thing would have to happen for Australia, maybe a similar thing for India as well, because we'd love to get round to the Darjeeling and Himalayan and the Nilgiri Mountain Railway at some stage. That's always been on the bucket list. Possibly South Africa as well, but depending on the social situation out there,
absolutely,
it could get dangerous.
And also the what's running at what time. I think Sandstone's usually a good bet.
Sandstone's on the bucket list for sure. Any overseas trip that we do in the future will need very careful planning, as we've planned in the past. A lot of people think that we can just film what we want, when we want, and just wing it. But it's really not like that. The number of times that I've planned stuff and then it all goes wrong at the last minute is so commonplace, it's so frustrating that it's difficult to sustain that willpower. But we get through it one way or the other.
Can you name a time when you were forced to improvise and how that turned out?
You could say I've had to improvise with the shooting schedule and the release schedule of every episode of Slips that's been going, because every year my crew and I, we get together on Skype and we go through the checklist of which locomotives we've covered so far and which ones are closer to completion than others and what activities they're up to on the heritage circuit over the next 12 months. Okay, this engine's coming back in 3 months' time, this one's going out of service in 6 months, and that one's going to that railway over that gala weekend, etc., etc. And we try to plan our movements around all of that, but then subject to any locomotives breaking down or going out of service for any number of reasons, any premature number of reasons, those plans are always subject to change at the very last minute. Somebody once said to me that you can never guarantee that the engine you've arranged to film on the front of a train is actually going to be on the front of that train until it turns up. And they're absolutely right. I remember one situation in January 2015. There were two Jubilees that were due to run a rail tour from Carnforth to Carlisle. It was Leander and Galatea, however you say that name. And the tour started off in Manchester, and it was due to change over to steam running from Carnforth to the north. And I booked my tickets to go and see them both about 6 weeks in advance, because it was the cheapest I was able to get to it at that particular time. And it was only when I got as far as Lancaster on my train up there that word got through on the grapevine that both of them had failed, and it was going to be Ian Riley's Black 5 45407 on the front. So I'd gone all that way up north.
Not that there's anything wrong with
45407. No, not at all. It's a great engine. It's a good workhorse, but
not one on
your
list.
Wasn't... Yeah, I covered those 3 years before and I didn't need to do them anymore. So I just enjoyed my day out and got a few nice shots of the engine going up to Carlisle. But it wasn't what I needed.
That is the gamble, isn't it? Well, that is documentary filmmaking.
Unfortunately, yes. Because you can't stop the clock on any heritage line and say, could you run this engine another 6 weeks outside its border ticket for me just so I can get those next couple of shots? You can't do that, you know. I do tend to run myself ragged sometimes, not out of choice, but because I have to. And people say to me, why do you wear yourself out so much? Take a sabbatical, take 6 weeks off. I can't do that because, you know, once you miss those operating days, they're gone. So,
and like you say, if a loco goes out of ticket, there's no knowing when it's going to come back.
Exactly. Like when Cidia Churro went out of service early 2013 and I thought, I'll be dead before she returns to service, that may be true.
What's left for Chris Eden Green to do?
Plenty. There's a checklist of about 34, 35 different types of steam locomotive that I haven't covered yet, which I'm currently working on. And then there's another dozen or so which I've still yet to start, you know, most of them overseas types. As for what the immediate future holds for steam locos in profile, you can expect a lot more industrials from me in the future. You can expect maybe a little less of the Big Four standard gauge or BR standard gauge. You can expect more narrow gauge and miniature types in the short to mid-term future. Beyond that, it's difficult to say, really. Although I've had bad experiences with mainstream television in the past, I wouldn't rule it out altogether if Amazon Prime were to come to me tomorrow and say, here's £5 million, Chris, go and make your first series, just do it. You know, I would take that up in a flash. But having said that, I would be very careful with creative control, because it's very easy to be taken in by somebody and then you have to toe their line, effectively. So they would say, okay, you can make this series, but you've got to do this, 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 and this. And then once you've done enough of this, 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 and this, it no longer becomes your vision, it becomes theirs. And there's that danger of, do I really want to attach myself to this name, to this project? At this point in time, who really knows? But there's a lot still to do, and the railway ahead looks forever more appealing. So we'll see where it takes us.
Fantastic. Chris, thank you so much for coming on Railway Mania. It's been a pleasure having you.
It's been great for you to have me on, so thank you very much.
Looking forward to see lots more steam locos in profile, gauge issue, and much more from you in the future.
It'll be coming.
If you'd like to buy steam locos in profile on DVD, please check out Chris's shop at e-gmedia.co.uk/shop. If you want to see more of Chris's videos, including new episodes of Steam Locos in Profile and Gauge the Issue, the YouTube channel is Chris Eden Green.